My name is Rick Dunning. I'm a geographer and geologist. I live in Northfield, Minnesota, and teach both of those subjects on the college level. And I have a particular interest in environmental change, how it happens and what the effects of those environmental changes are. That includes both natural kinds of environmental change and human-induced kinds of environmental change. And today's topic, as well as yesterday's topic, concerned climate change and the way that people influence climate. Today I'd like to focus specifically on what's called in the popular press the greenhouse effect. It has gotten a lot of attention, particularly in the last year, because of the drought of 1988, the long hot summer of last year, which was really an extension of the drought of 1987, and in many places is continuing as the drought of 1989, so that it has been an extensive dry period in Earth history. We've heard a lot about the problem in, as I say, the popular press, and what I'd like to try and do is define what the greenhouse effect is briefly, talk about its causes and the evidence to support the fact that it's really happening, and then talk about some of the things that might be done to slow down the greenhouse effect. Now, let's begin just again with a brief introduction to climate as the long-term average weather conditions of a location. Our weather systems and our climatic system operate on energy. And the source of energy for our global system is the sun. The Earth gets its energy almost exclusively from the sun. We do have some geothermal energy, heat coming from inside the Earth. But for the most part, the energy that our system operates on comes from the sun in the form of sunlight. We see coming out here. Sunlight penetrates through the atmosphere very easily, as long as there aren't too many clouds, too much dust in the atmosphere. And then that sunlight is absorbed by the Earth, which causes the Earth to heat up. And then the heat that the Earth gives off is absorbed by the atmosphere. And that is the way that the atmosphere is heated up. So the steps again, the sun heats the Earth and the Earth heats the atmosphere in that order. So that whole process is called the greenhouse effect by climatologists. It's a natural process. It's a very important process because without that greenhouse effect, the temperature of the Earth would effectively be cold the whole time. The atmosphere traps in the heat from the Earth, and that's what provides us with our warmth. Now, in the atmosphere, the main gas responsible for absorbing heat is carbon dioxide, plus water vapor to a certain extent. Carbon dioxide makes up about 0.03% of the atmosphere, the total volume of the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is about 0.03%.
What keeps the carbon dioxide from absorbing the heat when the sun comes through the atmosphere the first time to warm the heat?
When the sunlight comes through the atmosphere, the radiation is shortwave radiation, high intensity radiation, and the carbon dioxide does not absorb that shortwave kind of radiation. But when the heat comes from the Earth, the radiation is in the form of longer wavelengths, which are absorbed by the carbon dioxide. It's called the greenhouse effect because theoretically that's how a greenhouse works. The glass of the greenhouse lets the sun in and then traps the heat inside. That's not exactly how a greenhouse really works, But that's how it's been, that's where the term comes from. Now, as an environmental problem, the real concern with the greenhouse effect is that people are adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere through burning fossil fuels. Wood, coal, natural gas, oil. Whenever you burn something, the combustion gives off carbon dioxide as a natural byproduct. So it's not a typical pollutant. It does not have any adverse health effects. It doesn't hurt you to breathe it. We breathe carbon dioxide all the time. But the real concern with carbon dioxide as a pollutant, as I say, is that when you add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, then more heat will be absorbed and the atmosphere will get warmer. So the greenhouse effect as an environmental problem really refers to warming of the atmosphere by pollution or by the addition of carbon dioxide. Now there are other pollutants that have the same effect besides carbon dioxide. Methane, which is given off by a variety of sources. Landfills give off methane. Livestock gives off methane. Termites in the tropics give off methane. Rice paddies give off methane. It's a natural product of decomposition. And methane also absorbs heat. Nitrous oxides, which are a byproduct of coal burning operations, also give off or act as a greenhouse gas. They absorb heat. And chlorofluorocarbons, which are better known for their adverse effects on the ozone layer, also absorb a lot of heat when they're in the atmosphere. All of those pollutants have the same effect as the added carbon dioxide. So they're all what scientists refer to as greenhouse gases.
There's methane, chlorofluorocarbons,
and nitrous oxides. Now this problem is made worse by the process of deforestation because trees naturally absorb carbon dioxide. And so when you're cutting down large areas of forest, particularly tropical rainforest, you're removing a natural sink for carbon dioxide to go into. And we also have to recognize that there are natural sources of carbon dioxide, particularly volcanic eruptions and forest fires all give off carbon dioxide. So the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has varied naturally through time. Now, what does this heating process mean for the environment? One, it means that our climate will get warmer, and as it gets warmer, it will therefore get drier. So the drought effects of last summer give us some sense of what the climate change might be like toward hotter, and whenever it's hotter, it will therefore be drier because there's more evaporation taking place. That will totally shift climatic patterns on the Earth's surface, so that if you imagine all the climates of the modern day Earth's surface kind of shifting northward slightly, the tropics will get bigger, the subtropical areas will get bigger, and everything will just shift north. All of the vegetation patterns will shift northward. All of the ecological communities will be displaced to the north. Now, along with this trend toward warmer, drier conditions, we would expect more frequent droughts and more severe droughts to accompany that. Again, kind of going back to the effects of last summer. And one of the major concerns is that the heat, the added heat in the atmosphere, will cause present-day glaciers to melt, which will fill up the oceans with more water and flood many coastal locations and coastal cities. Now, the amount of melting is, at this point, uncertain. But there will be, if temperatures continue to rise, there will be some increased melting of the polar ice caps. And there's a lot of water tied up in ice on the Earth's surface, even though we don't think about that. That is the major location for fresh water, is ice on the Earth's surface at this point.
Question. Mm-hmm. The temperature of Puget Sound has been going up since around 1900. 79 or 80.
Mm-hmm.
And that's changed the spawning patterns of many fish, among other things. And I wonder, does that relate to any of this at all? Or is that another factor somewhere?
It's quite possible. Now we get into the realm of the more complex feedbacks that are related to this global warming. What else happens as a result of the warming? One would be, you'd expect, an increase in sea surface temperatures. Well, sea surface temperatures have a major impact on our climatic patterns because they affect the movement of the jet stream, the movement of storm systems across North America. So that changing the sea surface temperatures may have some other kinds of climatic effects that we can't anticipate yet. Changing the sea surface temperature will also change ecologically the plankton in the ocean. We don't know if it will increase or decrease at this point, but plankton are the microscopic plants in the ocean that also absorb carbon dioxide and give off oxygen. Well, we don't know what the effects might be on plankton. Another effect might be an increase in cloud cover, because as temperatures get warmer, there will be more water evaporating from the ocean. That water will condense and form clouds. Now, again, the question is, what's the effect of more clouds? Some people suggest that will cause a cooling trend and counteract the greenhouse effect. Other people say that the clouds will act like a blanket and hold the heat in, and that will increase the warming effects of the greenhouse effect. If this temperature change is very rapid, then we could be looking at major problems with extinctions of plants and animals that live in at present times in ecologically fragile areas. So that we're looking at the possibility of some major changes ecologically, environmentally, and as a result also major economic and social changes if this warming trend continues. The countries most likely to be affected will be those in the tropical and subtropical areas, which today are mostly the poorer countries, the less developed countries. And as they experience warmer, drier conditions, it will be more difficult to feed the people in those countries from their own resources. Now, is this real? Is the greenhouse effect a real thing? Records kept in Hawaii show a measured increase in carbon dioxide since the Industrial Revolution. So yes, there is an increase in the amount of carbon dioxide. That has been proven. There is increasing evidence that warming is taking place. The six warmest years in the last century, the last 100 years, the six warmest years have been in the 1980s. And the warmest 2 years of the last century were 1988 and 1987.
What about 1936? I thought that was warmer. At least in the Midwest, where I live.
In the Midwest, yeah. We're talking global averages.
Okay, global.
Global averages. And in the last 100... yeah, go ahead.
But in the warmer areas, there are more plants, aren't there? And vegetation that should absorb more of the carbon dioxide?
Should, yes.
And give off more oxygen? Doesn't that happen?
Go ahead.
You probably have figures. How many thousand square miles are we killing off of the Amazon each month, day, whatever your figures?
You know, you sometimes hear quotes of 1 million acres a day at that rate of deforestation. So yes, there, under natural conditions, there would have been extensive areas of plant cover, but a lot of that is being destroyed and much of it is being burned, and the burning process is giving off more CO2. In the last 100 years, carbon dioxide has increased by about 0.005% of a percent. Seems like a very slight amount, but given the small amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere originally, that's a significant increase. The temperatures in the last 100 years have gone up about 1 degree Fahrenheit average over that period. Most of the increase has been in the last 30 years. Scientists are predicting anywhere from a 3 degree to a 5 degree, or 3 to 7 degree temperature increase by the year 2050. 3 to 7 degrees, 3 to 9 degrees, depending on who you're listening to. They're calling for about that much temperature increase in the global average. Now, it may not seem like much, but the difference between the glacial and non-glacial periods during the Ice Age is only about a 7 degree difference in the global average temperature. So it doesn't take much of a fluctuation in our average temperature to make some drastic changes in global climates. One other piece of evidence that has supported the notion of a greenhouse effect has come through the study of gas bubbles that are trapped in glaciers, little air bubbles in the ice of the glaciers. And by drilling down through the glacier, you can examine air of different ages. And by examining the CO2 content of this ancient atmosphere trapped in the ice, there's a good indication that glacial fluctuations have been very closely tied to changes in the carbon dioxide level. And that when the carbon dioxide level goes up, temperatures go up and the glaciers melt. When the carbon dioxide level goes down, temperatures are cooler and glaciers expand. That's the evidence suggested by these glacial studies.
Thanks.
Yeah, go ahead.
You said 3 to 7% of a degree in the overall climate is expected within the next...
By the year 2050.
By 2050.
3 to 7 degrees Fahrenheit increase.
Thank
you. Now, much of this carbon dioxide pollution comes from our heavy reliance on fossil fuels. It's a major central part of our economic system is the use of fossil fuels in automobiles, factories, to generate electricity. Particularly now that energy prices are so low. Remember the 1970s, the mid-70s and late-70s with the energy crisis. As prices for energy went up, then the whole global economy went essentially into a tailspin. So we're very much reliant on energy, and right now energy is very cheap. So we're using a lot of it, and the rate of energy use is increasing. The way to decrease the greenhouse effect is to cut back on energy use. At first to try and slow down the rate of warming, and then eventually to try and stop the warming. But at this point, the key is to try and slow it down. In this respect, we are looking at the prospect of a new energy crisis. Not so much because energy supplies are low, but because the atmosphere can't handle any more carbon dioxide without the temperature changes. To slow down the warming effect, we need about a 20% decrease in energy use, and to stop the warming, we need about a 50% decrease in energy use. Our current trends would put us at a 100% increase in our energy use by the year 2040, so that we're rapidly increasing energy use right now in a time when we should be cutting back. In the U.S., which has 5% of the population, we produce about 23% of the carbon dioxide that gets into the atmosphere. An average of 18 tons per person per year in the United States, 18 tons of carbon dioxide per person per year. So the general goals for cutting back on carbon dioxide use will be the use of natural gas in the short run, more efficient use of energy and conservation methods, More use of renewable energy resources, particularly solar. Reforestation projects, or at least to slow down the deforestation. The ban of chlorofluorocarbons, which we are phasing out gradually. Essentially, many of the same things that we were told to do in the 70s in response to the energy crisis, now we need to take up again in response to the global warming crisis. The problem is with global warming, and this is different from the energy crisis a little bit, is that the effort must be a global effort because climate affects the whole world, not just one country. And it's very difficult to try and implement any kind of international energy program. There are no incentives for countries to cut back on their energy use unless everyone is cutting back on their energy use. And that brings up the ethical questions of who should bear the burdens of these cutbacks. There are a lot of inequalities with respect to the less developed countries at the moment, and how much of this cutback should they bear and still be able to continue their development programs. I did a little of this yesterday, but having said something about general things that we need to do to reduce the greenhouse effect, let's look at a few personal things, or look at this on a more personal level. First of all, in terms of energy use, 1 gallon of gasoline contributes about 20 pounds of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. So every time you burn a gallon of gasoline, about 20 pounds of CO2. So 10,000 gallons of gasoline, you're contributing about, 5 tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. 1 kilowatt hour of electricity contributes about 2 pounds if it comes from a coal-fired plant rather than a hydro plant.
5,000 tons? What did you say, 1 gallon?
10,000 gallons of gasoline would be 5 tons of carbon dioxide. But 1 gallon of gasoline is 20 pounds. And 100 cubic feet of natural gas contributes about 12 pounds. 1 mile of an airplane flight contributes about 0.5 pound per person. So that this gives you an idea of the direct amount of carbon dioxide that people contribute into the atmosphere. So you could pretty much take up the measure how much electricity you use, how much gas you burn, and figure out your personal contribution to the carbon dioxide buildup. And then this is the direct contribution. But remember that you're also contributing carbon dioxide indirectly through the processing of food, the consumption of goods and services, any products that require electricity or fossil fuels to manufacture also contribute. So if you take your direct contribution and double that, then you'd have just about the right amount for how much carbon dioxide you produce in a given year. Now, at the present time, the world is adding about 22 billion tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere every year. 22 billion tons. And as I say, in order to cut back and stop the global warming trend, we need to cut our pollution, our carbon dioxide pollution, in half. So we need to cut back from 22 billion tons per year to about 11 billion tons per year. That means effectively each person can contribute about 2 tons per year. That is your personal allotment for carbon dioxide contributions. If you take that 11 billion tons and divide it by the 5 billion person population of the world, if we were to cut back effectively, that's what we should all aim for on an individual level, about 2 tons per year. Present time, most of us are way over that. I was calculating it just on the basis of my commuting and gas mileage, and figuring that just in terms of gasoline, I'm way over my allotment without much problem. Again, what do we do on a personal level to try and counteract these effects? And the main thing is to use less energy. That is the biggest single thing that you can do on a personal level. To use more efficient light bulbs. The new compact fluorescents are very, very efficient in terms of energy use. They may cost more than regular light bulbs, but ultimately they will save you electricity in the long run and pay for themselves fairly quickly. More efficient appliances, more efficient automobiles, avoiding products that have chlorofluorocarbons in them, recycling, again, not only cuts back on waste, but also uses less energy when you recycle the materials. Yeah. Insulating homes, again, many of the same things that we heard over and over in the 1970s become more important on a personal level here in the 1990s, which we're about to embark on. Planting trees does at least a little bit. Each tree absorbs about 50 pounds of CO2 per year, but trees also provide shade in the summertime, which cuts back on the amount that you need to spend on cooling in the summertime. There are other benefits that go along with these kinds of cutbacks, these kinds of savings. One, there's less in terms of other kinds of pollutants produced, decrease in acid rain, decrease in smog, less environmental damage in the form of oil spills and strip mining if we cut back on energy use, less destruction of the ozone layer by cutting back on chlorofluorocarbons. And economically, if we cut back our reliance on foreign oil and our use of foreign oil, which is so high at the present time, better trade deficits and presumably a better national security position. So there are some, as I say, some benefits that go along with these kinds of efforts to personally cut back on energy use. I think that is what I meant to say by way of introduction to this topic. Maybe we could just talk about it more generally now in the form of questions or other comments.
Yeah. One of my deepest concerns is that if my reading is correct, our federal government has officially said that the greenhouse effect is nothing to worry about. That all the figures, which I would say I tend to agree with yours as being somewhat rosy, if anything, are all nonsense, and that our government has, under our previous president, said, no, this is just a cyclical trend which we'll be out of in a few years. We should not do anything as a nation about this. That leaves it up to us to do something.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. And at the same time, many important scientists are coming out strongly in public saying it is a problem. And there's so much conflicting information generated by those sides in the media that it's difficult for us average people to have a sense of what's really going on with the problem. In that sense, education becomes even more important, so that people have a chance to understand what is happening or what the prospects might be.
And you said that going down into the icy found little boat, which would determine the fluctuation of the heat, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They determine it's the, due to the composition of the atmosphere.
And it's due to carbon dioxide, right? Okay, then what explains for the fluctuations in the carbon dioxide force annihilated, throughout the Earth globally, or is there, have there been cataclysms which would explain for the fluctuation?
Well, it's clear that by natural processes, carbon dioxide has been fluctuating in the atmosphere. It may be changes in natural changes in vegetation cover or plankton in the ocean, that sometimes there's more carbon dioxide absorbed, or the carbon dioxide is absorbed more efficiently, and that decreases the amount in the atmosphere. There may be times when more carbon dioxide is produced during periods of heightened volcanic activity, for example. You could have, and there have been periods in which volcanoes were much more active than they are at the present time. That varies from time to time throughout geologic history. So that there are times when CO2 would be produced in greater amounts. So that not just how it's produced, but how it's absorbed and the relative amounts of production versus absorption and how they play against each other throughout geologic history, I think, help to explain that.
So one of the discussions was on what explains the disappearance of the dinosaur. One idea was proposed that there was a lot of volcanoes, which would then turn shut off the light and make the Earth colder. Mm-hmm. But actually, in that sense, it isn't really shutting off the light, but it would be maybe more of the impact of the amount of carbon dioxide.
That would be another possibility, because a rapid increase in carbon dioxide and any kind of rapid environmental change tends to produce a lot of ecological damage, mass extinctions. And it's the rate of environmental change that, if it's slow, then usually the ecosystems can adapt to it. But if it's a sudden environmental change, then it's more difficult for organisms to adapt, and you get the mass extinctions. There are many other theories with respect to the dinosaur extinctions. One of the popular ones at the moment is the asteroid impact theory, that it's not volcanoes erupting, but the impact of a very large asteroid on the Earth that creates dust clouds or fires or climate changes that in turn had that same effect of cooling the Earth and causing the extinction.
Well, the increase of carbon dioxide, once again, you're saying increase of carbon dioxide would warm the Earth.
Yes.
Okay, and a decrease likewise. The impact of volcanoes have been, though, immediately a cooling of the Earth, right?
Yes, because of the ash in the atmosphere.
And then a long term would be the warming, right?
Longer term, you might expect the warming from the carbon dioxide, yeah. And that depends on the nature of the volcanic eruptions, too. Sometimes with volcanic eruptions, you don't get explosive eruptions, you get lava flows. And those might be give off more gas and less ash and create the warming trend. Whereas in areas like the Pacific Northwest, explosive eruptions are more common because of the chemistry of the lava. And those tend to produce a lot of ash and virtually no lava when they erupt. So there are some other variables.
Well, then, just going on with the scenario of extinction, if you had mass killing of animals, then that would increase methane gas then into the atmosphere? Or would that be a very minuscule amount?
I think the amount would be relatively minor.
Minuscule.
Yeah. Although, certainly possible. Yeah. Questions or comments?
Are there any answers to a country like Brazil, who I've read Brazil accounts for up to, 60-70% of the world's oxygen is produced in the rainforests, who has a massive world debt, and just the interest alone is killing. They say, no, but we have to deforest our jungles. We put aside some of the other awesome ecological things that we're losing there. How can we sit and say to them, you can't cut your forest, you can't sell your wood, you can't do these things because we need to breathe?
Right. That's a very
complex question just in the economics of it.
Yes, the economics and the ethics of it, exactly right. The kinds of problems that we face on an international scale are very difficult to try to overcome.
In the Northwest, when we think of energy, most of our energy really comes from electrical source, you know, and it's hydraulic energy. Okay, to what extent, I don't know what the rest of the world does as far as burning fossil fuel to get electrical energy. Is that
much of our Midwest electricity is from coal-fired plants?
I see, because I personally have never seen that.
Yeah. And much of the energy.
That's why here in the Northwest, when we say I cut down my electricity, I can't really.
With hydropower, that's you're not producing any CO2, certainly, but there aren't so many places in the world that are blessed with these kinds of energy resources.
If there are 22 billion tons being added to the atmosphere of carbon dioxide every year, how much does the atmosphere or the forestation and so forth, does the world vegetation take care of, usually, of that?
That I don't know. I'm sorry.
As
I say, each tree absorbs about 50 pounds per year. So in a forest like this in the Cascades is a fairly significant sink for carbon dioxide. But that's only a temporary sink in the sense that when the tree dies and decays, or if the tree is burned, then that carbon dioxide is released back into the atmosphere. It's only if the tree were used for lumber that it would not be, it would stay in the wood rather than being released back.
So
it's not a permanent permanent place for the carbon dioxide to remain.
I remember Kennedy quoted somebody, and he said that it's better to light one candle and curse the darkness. Remember that when he said that? And the bumper stickers. But I don't believe most people believe that. In fact, I'm convinced most people don't believe that. I'm convinced that most Americans won't believe that. And therefore, personal solutions to all this are, it almost falls in the category, I think, of a cruel joke to think that personal solutions are going to accomplish anything with it. Yeah. And the solutions that might do something are so radical that I can't imagine them occurring in my lifetime. The world government idea,
yeah.
Those kinds of things. I thought at one time maybe the shift to world economy was going to lead us into world government, but I don't think I believe that anymore. At least I don't think it's as likely as I thought it was a few years ago when I was being more hopeful than realistic. But yeah, what do you think? I mean, surely one gets kind of cynical about all this after a while.
Well, the kind of lifestyle changes that would be required with a kind of a complete restructuring of our economic system that this would bring about do seem almost impossible without
the imposition of something.
Yeah.
And that's the tragedy.
So eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die.
Well, no, or tomorrow, tomorrow the dictator takes over. The dictator who is an environmentalist. And then who'll tell you that you can only produce half the...
You only get your 2 tons.
That's right. But he's the same guy that's going to say you can only have 1.4 kids and do all that kind of stuff. And that's that seems to me to be probably the only way it'll ever happen. And I would just, I don't know if I'd want to live in this country if it were like that. And yet, what solution is there?
But where else would you go?
Well, you know, getting down to it, I agree with him. I much doubt that anyone would change their lifestyle, I mean, as a whole, but we would change our lifestyle.
Because you drive the freeway.
But yeah, right. But I'd say, what if we work, what do you think, you know, in trying to figure out the whole problem of the world? What if we changed, like, for instance, set up more hydroelectric plants, the other words, the hydroelectric plants? Let's switch, I'm going to say something evil here, but let's switch from fossil fuels to atomic fuel, okay? And in other words, do that instead, so that, I don't know, the electric car never really went big. But you know, if we somehow had gotten the idea of we can slowly switch into an electric car that was more efficient. Okay, what do you think of that? The idea of the combination, as opposed to asking everybody to cut down on their lifestyle.
Well, certainly I think we need to consider all the alternatives, although safety factors aside, with the nuclear plants, I think that the cost of nuclear electricity right now is so high for the amount that you get out of it that I'm not sure it represents a viable, widely applicable solution. I think that we can accomplish more with alternatives and conservation and more efficient use of the electricity than we can with an expensive source of electricity like that. If we made some genuine efforts toward high efficiency automobile engines and high efficiency electrical appliances,
right,
and maybe more public transportation, I don't know, but genuine efforts toward efficiency and conservation, I think those would be ultimately more affordable and more effective and less disruptive to our lifestyle.
But is that going to work?
It worked in the late 70s with OPEC and the high prices of oil in the late 70s led to fairly effective conservation efforts. People were cutting back because the oil was more expensive. But when, with the oil glut and the kind of the breakdown of the cohesiveness of OPEC, energy is cheaper again. So we feel like that's less a problem.
There was an interview with Dwayne Berenson, the Secretary of Transportation, isn't he? Some Washingtonian, I think that's what he's anyway. And he was being asked, what are we doing to solve the problem, the impending problem of gridlock in Seattle? Because it's coming, you know? And he said the main solution right now is to encourage people to carpool. And the way you encourage them to carpool is you have an alternative lane on the freeway called the carpool lane. And you can only drive in that lane if you have, on the east side, I guess it's two or more, on the west side of the Seattle city, it's three or more people. And I thought to myself, boy, I drive that freeway a lot, and I sure see a lot of people whom that has not affected one whit.
One of the reasons.
Not that much.
One of the reasons that in Seattle they put that express lane on the side where the incoming traffic comes and goes out instead of on the inner lane. And who wants to drive where the traffic is coming in and out all the time? If you're going to have an express lane, it should be in the center lane. I mean, in the inside lane.
Well, they put it on the outside lane because it's a fast lane.
Fast lane should never be on the right if traffic's going to come in and out of that lane.
It isn't. It's on the left part of it.
When I saw it in Seattle, I could hardly believe it.
Well, on the east side, it's on the right.
On the west side on I-5, it's on the left.
Oh, it should be on the left, but in many places it's on the right, and I just about died. You know, what on earth, who wants to drive there? You're not gonna make time waiting for cars to come and go off of it. It does help in the Twin Cities. I know the places that they've tried it, they have it on the inside lane, and that helps. There are people that take that all the time. But what I'm wondering about the simple little things like styrofoam and spray cans and stuff, does that do anything significant?
In the United States, except for a few products, the chlorofluorocarbons have been effectively eliminated from spray cans.
Yeah. And if we can do it in those kind of things, then why can't we use public pressure to get manufacturers not to use the kind of things in gas, for instance, if we all did something else to not use gas, or diesel is just as bad, isn't it?
I think diesel's about, not significantly different from other gasoline.
What was that 100 FP gas?
That's 100 cubic feet of natural gas.
100 cubic feet of natural gas, like in your furnaces?
Yeah, or ovens or that type of thing.
Then how's the hole in the ozone layer affect even the carbon dioxide?
Essentially not. They are separate problems in their impact on our Earth's environment. They are related in the sense that chlorofluorocarbons contribute to both of those problems. But the decrease of the ozone layer has not had a major impact on the warming process. It's just the concern there is more dealing with the harmful ultraviolet radiation and the effects of that. The ozone layer in the atmosphere shields the Earth from ultraviolet radiation from the sun.
You mean from absorbing the heat of the sun as it comes in the first time instead of going directly to the
It actually blocks out the ultraviolet rays, which are the rays that cause sunburn. Those are the harmful rays. And most of those are blocked out by the ozone layer. Mm-hmm. If the ozone layer is decreased by the effects of pollution, then more ultraviolet radiation will get through, and we will have problems with increased skin cancer and perhaps some effects on crop production as a result.
Maybe Malthus was right that ultimately we will things will sort of level themselves out because we mess ourselves over.
No.
Yeah. And we'll kill ourselves to the point where we'll cut back enough so we can kind of get another start and go up, and then it'll cut back again. Except in his day it was wars and plagues and all that kind of stuff. But now we have greenhouse effects.
To get more people to kill off, so then we'll conserve, because less people to give off the carbon dioxide.
Well, you were saying that people aren't really changed. If you put this in purely economic terms, at the moment, Peugeot, Fiat, Mercedes, and BMW all have prototype automobiles that are 6 passengers or greater that average over 100 miles per gallon. Hmm. The reason they're not producing them is because the United States doesn't want that.
What does that mean? That the United States doesn't want that?
The Detroit automakers have said that they don't want to gear up for this, and I threw it in the 70s. And we people said, no, I don't want to drive that little car that doesn't have air conditioning, that gets 40 and 50 miles an hour a gallon. I want to drive my big car that gets around 18 or 20, maybe. And the other point is...
But you just said that they have a 6-passenger vehicle that gets...
Over 100. Some of them up to 146 is the highest figure I've seen.
My goodness.
Those are already available in Europe in prototype models.
Yeah.
I think the other question becomes, the United States, which is now the world's largest debtor nation, We owe over $400 billion. If we were to increase the fleet average of the United States automobiles by 3 miles per gallon, we could, by the year 2000, totally wipe out our national debt, if we had the will to spend the savings to pay back the national debt. Our people in Congress say it's not bad to have such a national debt, witnessed by what they've done.
What are the companies? Can you go through that again? I'm just
Peugeot, Fiat.
Peugeot. How do you spell Peugeot?
P-U-E-G-O-T. If you want to read a good article, yeah, up in the reading room right here, there's a magazine called Context. It comes out of the Pacific Northwest, but I'm a Midwesterner. Mm-hmm. They've got one of the issues that's sitting up there talks about the very issues we're talking about today. Okay. Quite eloquently.
But what are the cars of BMW?
Mercedes, Peugeot, Fiat.
And they can get up to
They have prototype models. Please, I'm not telling you that that's what they're churning out.
Prototype.
Of a big car.
Six passenger minimums.
Yeah.
Yes. Family automobiles. Not a little roller skate.
Yeah.
And I've seen a car that will demonstrate that can run on pellets, and energy pellets that comes from plastics and organic material, and was used. The guy had to he's one of those Mother Earth, you know.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, it was run completely though on pellets and stuff, absolutely without gas. And to run quite a distance though, he still had to work on it. He had to use quite a few pellets. But it was almost virtually pollution-less. Pollution-free.
Well, you can also get a pollution-free wood stove. But almost nobody buys them because they're expensive, they're big, the Russian stove, the German stove. But people don't like them.
Cost more.
Well, they don't cost much to run. You burn them twice a day. No fly ash practically and all this. It's really wonderful. But they don't catch on very quickly.
I think we also, kind of your point with the cars, we also need to think about where a lot of power resides in North America, and that is not necessarily with the voters or a Congress, but with corporations. And if you look at, say, the Fortune 500, the top 20 firms are oil companies or automobile companies or other companies that use oil and chemicals. And that's where a tremendous amount of economic power resides.
And so they have agreed not to make this so that the oil company will be happy so that there's not competition.
In essence, it's not in Exxon's or Standard Oil's or GM's or Ford's interests to necessarily pursue these kinds of developments.
But
what they care about is profits.
If people knew about them and asked them to be in production,
how hard we have to ask.
Yeah. You have to buy an awful lot of stock before they would listen.
Yeah.
And so when we talk about personal choices, we are up against a lot of power in terms of who really kind of runs the show. And that makes it harder. It makes it a lot harder.
I know, I can see why the wood burning stoves don't catch on, because then you're cutting the forest down again, and then you've got the same problem all over again. You're burning the wood, right?
But you're not producing the same kinds of pollution, are you?
Well, you'd still be producing carbon dioxide, but again, it comes down to the efficiency of the stove. If you can get a lot of heat out of a fairly small amount of wood, then yes, you're still polluting, but not nearly as badly as burning coal to produce electricity or...
But as well as polluting, you're also depleting the carbon dioxide absorbing trees, which is double whammy. So
yeah, but that out here, you live in the Northwest?
No, but I enjoy the amount of trees you have. I hate to see them.
Well, we lived on Vashon Island for 9 years, and I swear, I think 80% of the people there burn wood for heat. Mm-hmm. And most of those who burn wood burn it all the time. Mm-hmm. They really burn a lot of wood down there. And they found that the alder tree, which is a fast-growing, it isn't really hard, but it's harder than soft wood.
It burns very hot.
It burns hot, burns well. I don't know, I think they kind of had it down to a fine art there. There weren't very many of those old airy furnaces left, wood burning stoves. And there were a few of the big Russian stoves, which were nice. Have you ever seen one of those?
Yeah.
It's quite a marvel. Really a marvel.
But as you say, you wouldn't go through tons of cords of wood, you know, every year, because if you had a real efficient thing, that's the main thing.
What are you doing personally to protect against the greenhouse effect? What do you recommend for us?
I guess energy conservation is what I'm concentrating on myself. Just trying to cut back in the ways that I use electricity as much as I can, and gasoline and natural gas.
Like they told me when I called the University of Minnesota the other day, just remember if you use only half, for instance, if you use a tablecloth, plastic tablecloth, if you use only twice instead of only once, you're cutting down half by half what you would have done otherwise.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a nice way of looking at it, that if you use paper cups two times, it's a lot more garbage, but if you...
So shifting from in this country, shifting from electric heat to natural gas is a reverse move, isn't it?
Sure.
Yeah, that's true.
On the Northwest, yeah.
I just did that too.
Shame on you.
Yeah, we went from electric to natural gas. Money?
Cheaper.
Oh, much?
Here in the Northwest.
Much cheaper.
May I warn you of what happened? I live in Illinois. 15 years ago, the electrical company said, we just put in a nuclear plant, we won't even be able to, we're just going to charge a flat fee, $5 or $10 a month for electricity, it's so cheap. And everybody moved to electric gas, or to electric heat. We now are paying over 12 cents per kilowatt hour.
Yes.
And it was simply a matter of, we've got enough people on it, it's too expensive to change. We changed anyway, we went to propane. And we have friends who pay $400 and $500 a month for heating 1 month in their home.
With electricity.
Yeah. And we're not talking huge homes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beware.
Well, I went from electricity to gas.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were on. Oh, okay.
I still have oil. To me, it's the cheapest.
Is it?
Make sure, though, you have to have an oil efficient burning. If you don't have an oil efficient burner, then forget it. To me, that's still cheap.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for all your participation.
Thank you.
Gee. Which hikes are you doing Monday and Friday?
Monday will be the short one. I'm aiming for the holding my compact.
Let's go and get
it. He's going to report Monday.
Oregon has successfully pioneered the.
Just around the dog.
They just built a big,
and then I'll go on to tomorrow.
A big east-west light rail system.
Okay.
Which the last time I heard a report on that, it was not going so well.
No, the one I'm talking about is Portland, Oregon. Has all these diamonds.
That's what I'm talking about. Portland, okay. Oregon.
And drive Portland, Oregon.
They have the what?
They have a little diamond out in the left-hand lane. You don't drive there unless there are certain people.
Seattle.
Yeah, you were saying it wasn't working, but...
Well, it doesn't. I don't see... It's empty.
Yeah, it's empty.
If it was working, there'd be people in it. You don't see anybody in it.
Yeah, Portland, I have seen lots of people driving.
Yeah.
You know, somehow it caught on. That was 10 years ago, but still.
Yeah. Portland, Oregon is, for some reason, they're way ahead of us, aren't they? Mm-hmm. They've had a bottle bill for 10 years, and we don't seem to be able to get one passed up here in this state. Crazy. Other ways, I think we're behind.
And the other thing is, we don't have that. Do you think we could develop some kind of a lifestyle of mass transportation? But that sure doesn't fit. That's un-American mass transportation. Taking the bus. only poor people take a bus.
My wife's parents are from Chicago, and a lot of people in Chicago rely on mass transportation. What do you do for people like, it sounds like you might get saved. You live 50 miles from the nearest getting there.
We've got a whole land use pattern in our urban areas that has evolved under cheap energy. And it doesn't lend itself well to converting to some other kinds of alternatives like carpooling or mass transit, because workplaces are scattered all over and homes are scattered all over and they're not together and people are going different ways at different times.
This is a Lutheran camp. And when they tell you about building a new Lutheran church, they tell you about the first thing you have to think about is be sure you build a nursery for the little children. But then be sure you build a big parking lot.
Yep.
Got to have a big parking lot. Because nobody walks to church anymore. Everybody drives.
Yeah.
That's just the way we think.
Yeah.
That we're a
and same way with businesses.
They commuter everything.
How large is that parking lot? We start building.
And how easily accessible is it? Getting in and out into the flow of traffic and out of traffic. Those kinds of things. Yeah, you're right. I mean, we're based on it, aren't we?
Yeah. Have you ever seen an electric car? We're
just only some prototype models, but yeah.
I was down in Central Area and used to drive by and looked at this electric car dealer.
Was there one down here?
Uh-huh. And I'd go by and I'd take a look at that thing, you know, I'd go by and it was affordable.
Yeah, it was,
you know, about $3,000 or $4,000. But the problem was that it was a two-seater.
Yeah.